In Egypt, he had merely replaced old provincial governors by new ones. In India, he had defeated Porus, and then left him in power much as he found him, except that Porus was now called a satrap by the Greeks. Alexander had, it's true, planned out a number of towns, and some of them were to grow into great towns. 17 Alexandrias he founded altogether, but he had destroyed Tyre, and with Tyre the security of the sea routes, which had hitherto been the chief westward outlet for Mesopotamia. Historians say that he Hellenized the east, but Babylonia and Egypt swarmed with Greeks before his time. He wasn't the cause, he was a part of the Hellenization. For a time, the whole world, from the Adriatic to the Indus, was under one ruler. So far he had realized the dreams of Isocrates and Philip, his father. But how far was he making this a permanent and enduring union? How far, as yet, was it anything more than a dazzling but transitory flourish of his own magnificent self? He was making no great roads, setting up no sure sea communications. It's idle to accuse him of leaving education alone, because the idea that empires must be cemented by education was still foreign to human thought. But he was forming no group of statesmen around him. He was thinking of no successor. He was creating no tradition, nothing more than a personal legend. The idea that the world would have to go on after Alexander, engaged in any other employment than the discussion of his magnificence, seems to have been outside his mental range. He was still young, it's true, but well before Philip was 31, he had been thinking of the education of Alexander. Was Alexander a statesman at all? Some students of his career assure us that he was, that now, at Susa, he planned a mighty world empire, seeing it not simply as a Macedonian conquest of the world, but as a melting together of racial traditions. He did one thing, at any rate, that gives colour to this idea. He held a great marriage feast, in which he and 90 of his generals and friends were married to Persian brides. He himself married a daughter of Darius, though already he possessed an Asiatic wife in Roxana, the daughter of the king of Samarkand. This wholesale wedding was made a very splendid festival, and at the same time all of his Macedonian soldiers, to the number of several thousands who had married Asiatic brides, were given wedding gifts. This has been called the marriage of Europe and Asia. The two continents were to be joined, wrote Plutarch, in lawful wedlock, and by a community of offspring. And next he began to train recruits from Persia and the north, Parthians, Bactrians, and the like, in the distinctive disciplines of the phalanx and the cavalry. Was that also to assimilate Europe and Asia, or was it to make himself independent of his Macedonians? They thought the latter, at any rate, and mutinied, and it was with some difficulty that he brought them to a penitent mood and induced them to take part in a common feast with the Persians. The historians have made a long and eloquent speech for him on this occasion, but the gist of it was that he bade his Macedonians begone, and gave no sign of how he proposed they should get home out of Persia. After 3 days of dismay, they submitted to him and begged his forgiveness. Here's the matter for a very pretty discussion. Was Alexander really planning a racial fusion, or had he just fallen in love with the pomp and divinity of an Oriental monarch, and wished to get rid of these Europeans to whom he was only a king-leader? The writers of his own time, and those who lived near to his time, lean very much to the latter alternative. They insist upon his immense vanity. They relate how he began to wear the robes and tiara of a Persian monarch. At first, only before the barbarians, and privately, but afterwards he came to wear it in public, when he sat for the dispatch of business. And presently he demanded Oriental prostrations from his friends. One thing seems to support the suggestion of great personal vanity in Alexander. His portrait was painted and sculptured frequently, and always he's represented as a beautiful youth, with wonderful locks flowing backward from a broad forehead. Previously, most men had worn beards, but Alexander, enamoured of his own youthful loveliness, wouldn't part with it. He remained a sham boy at 32. He shaved his face, and so set a fashion in Greece and Italy that lasted many centuries. The stories of violence and vanity in his closing years cluster thick upon his memory. He listened to tittle-tattle about Philotas, the son of Parmenio, one of his most trusted and faithful generals. Philotas, it was said, had boasted to some woman he was making love to that Alexander was a mere boy, that but for such men as his father and himself, there would have been no conquest of Persia, and the like. Such assertions have a certain element of truth in them. The woman was brought to Alexander, who listened to her treacheries. Presently, Philotas was accused of conspiracy, and upon very insufficient evidence, tortured and executed. Then Alexander thought of Parmenio, whose other two sons had died for him in battle. He sent swift messengers to assassinate the old man before he could hear of his son's death. Now Parmenio had been one of the most trusted of Philip's generals. It was Parmenio who had led the Macedonian armies into Asia before the murder of Philip. There can be little doubt of the substantial truth of this story, nor about the execution of Callisthenes, the nephew of Aristotle, who refused Alexander divine honours and went about with as much pride as if he had demolished tyranny, while the young men followed him as the only free man among thousands. Mixed with such incidents, we have the very illuminating story of the drunken quarrel in which he killed Cletus. The monarch and his company had been drinking hard, and the drink had made the talk loud and free. There was much flattery of the young god, much detraction of Philip, at which Alexander had smiled with satisfaction. This drunken self-complacency was more than the Macedonians could stand. It roused Cletus, his foster brother, to a frenzy. Cletus reproached Alexander with his Median costume, and praised Philip. There was a loud quarrel, and to end it, Cletus was hustled out of the room by his friends. He was, however, in the obstinate phase of drunkenness, and he returned by another entrance. He was heard outside quoting Euripides in a bold and disrespectful tone. "Are these your customs? Is it thus that Greece rewards her combatants? Shall one man claim the trophies won by thousands?" Whereupon Alexander snatched a spear from one of his guards and ran Cletus through the body as he lifted the curtain to come in. Once forced to believe that this was the real atmosphere of the young conqueror's life. Then the story of his frantic and cruel display of grief for Hephaestion can scarcely be all invention. If it's true, or in any part true, it displays a mind ill-balanced and altogether wrapped up in personal things, to whom empire was no more than opportunity for egoistic display, and all the resources of the world, stuff for freaks of that sort of generosity which robs a thousand people to extort the admiration of one astounded recipient. Hephaestion, being ill, was put upon a strict diet, but in the absence of his physician at the theatre, he ate a roasted fowl and drank a flagon of iced wine, in consequence of which he died. Thereupon Alexander decided upon a display of grief. It was the grief of a lunatic. He had the physician crucified. He ordered every horse and mule in Persia to be shorn, and pulled down the battlements of the neighbouring cities. He prohibited all music in his camp for a long time, and having taken certain villages of the Cusaeans, he caused all the adults to be massacred, as a sacrifice to the Manes of Hephaestion. Finally, he set aside 10,000 talents, a talent equals £240, for a tomb. For those days this was an enormous sum of money, none of which things did any real honour to Hephaestion, but they served to demonstrate to an awe-stricken world what a tremendous thing the sorrow of Alexander could be. This last story, and many such stories, may be lies, or distortions, or exaggerations, but they have a vein in common. After a bout of hard drinking in Babylon, a sudden fever came upon Alexander in 323 BC, and he sickened and died. He was still only 33 years of age.